This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This is a WTOP original podcast.
Coming up in this episode of Target USA,
Iran is now a nuclear power.
They have enough right now to, within a matter of days or a week or two, have enough bomb-grade material for at least three bombs.
Washington Post national security correspondent Joby Warwick. After decades of sanctions and obstructive activities, Iran has reached its goal.
And then it would be a matter of, if the supreme leader gives the go-ahead, how quickly can they put the rest of it together?
So how long before they could launch one?
So that might be a couple years. It depends. There's some things we don't really know about how advanced they are.
Coming up on this episode, from WTOP in Washington, D.C., this is Target USA. America has a target on its back. And on this program, we investigate the threats, the people behind them, the agencies fighting them, and the impact on you. This is Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.
I'm J.J. Green. Joining us on this episode is Joby Warwick. He's a national security reporter at the Washington Post, someone I've known for a long time. And as you know, it's not often that I'll have a fellow national security correspondent on this program because essentially we do the same work. But where there is credit due, I give it. Joby's done a masterful job with this article that he wrote talking about Iran's nuclear program. So let's get to it. You've got a really serious story that you dropped today, and I think everybody in the world is watching this. It's called Nuclear Deal in Tatters, Iran Edges Close to Weapons Capability, and that's pretty scary, Joby. Break it down for us. What have you learned?
Well, it's the kind of thing that really this has been happening incrementally, and because it's incremental, because the figures and data show up in reports that only a few people read, and we're all distracted by Gaza and Ukraine. A lot has happened in the last year and a half with Iran's nuclear program. And it felt to me that I needed to step back to get some distance and to try to look at what has really happened over the last couple of years. And to do that, I went to Vienna, spent time talking to people who actually go inside Iran's nuclear facilities because they're weapons inspectors. Talk to intelligence people in Europe and the United States to try to get a sense of what Iran is doing. And the emerging picture, JJ, it's quite alarming in the sense that Iran sees itself as completely unfettered by really any meaningful restrictions. And it's decided to adopt a policy of getting as close as it possibly can to a nuclear weapons capability and reserving the option to make a bomb in the future if it decides to. And very cleverly, it's decided it doesn't want to cross that line for now. It doesn't want to give the Israelis or the Americans a reason to attack their facilities. But they can get really, really far down this road and kind of put that capability in their pocket and use it as a deterrence. And in fact, that's, as we get into the article, that's a word they're using now to talk about the capabilities they have.
How close are they to getting a weapon?
So there are several steps, but the big step always for Iran, the big thing that they had trouble getting to was having enough fissile material, getting enough highly enriched uranium or plutonium to build a nuclear weapon. All the other stuff, they had actually mostly worked out over the preceding periods in early 2000s. But the hard part was getting the enriched uranium and plutonium. And what we're saying in this article is they have enough right now to, within a matter of days or a week or two, have enough bomb-grade material for at least three bombs. You can talk to physics and weapons experts and say they actually have a lot more than that. But at the very least, they could make three bombs worth of nuclear or weapons-grade uranium, so the fuel, the fissile fuel for a bomb, in just a few days. And then it would be a matter of, if the supreme leader gives the go-ahead, how quickly can they put the rest of it together? And that's when you get a debate over, well, would it be a crude nuclear weapon that you could put in a truck or maybe deliver in a ship, a big heavy thing that would be kind of unwieldy. They could do that probably in 6 months or less. The harder part is to make something that's deliverable, a warhead that could fit into in the cone of a missile and get launched over long distances. And that's probably going to take them some time. But to get to that, breakout stage, they're actually pretty close right now.
So when you say it may take them some time to develop a delivery system and, I guess the miniaturization process is, what they'd have to do as well. How much time are you talking?
So that might be a couple years. It depends. There's some things we don't really know about how advanced they are. We know for a fact that before 2003, there was a period from about 2000, 2003, when they were really crashing on figuring out the other parts of a weapon. What does it take to have an implosion device where you have conventional explosives that compress a core of fissile material? And they performed tests on those kinds of devices and components. We know this because back in 2018, the Israelis had this daring raid of a warehouse in downtown Tehran, where Iran had stored a lot of its documents, the files from its nuclear program, and really ran off in the middle of the night with them and stole them, and then shared a lot of those documents, kind of released them so the world could see what Iran had been up to. And the picture that comes out of from that is they really were well down the road to being able to design at least a basic nuclear weapon. The hard part, and we've seen the North Koreans struggle with this, is miniaturizing it, getting it onto something that'll fit into the cone of a missile, and not just be able to fire it off, but have it to be able to re-enter the atmosphere if it's an intercontinental flight without being burned up in the atmosphere. There's all kinds of technical problems that you have to sort through. But Iran, now that it has its fissile material, for the most part, it's got time to play with those things, and it's much harder to detect that kind of research. You can't look at a satellite photo and say, well, we think they're working on a nuclear warhead design, because you really can't see that. And one of the consequences of the collapse of the Iran nuclear deal is that inspectors, international inspectors from the Nuclear Watchdog Agency in Vienna, can't run around Iran like they used to be able to and, look into, buildings and see exactly what Iran might be doing. That capability has been curtailed.
Joby, one of the sort of puzzling things about this is that Iran has been sanctioned for forever. Their nuclear program and all of that, but yet they keep inching closer. So I remember the late Dr. David Kay told me that a lot of this activity took place in Syria, and he used the bar scene from Star Wars to talk about how all these characters would meet up in Syria and these kind of deals and all this stuff got done that would provide this kind of capability or the tools or the pieces that Iran and others like North Korea might need to advance a program like this. So where are they getting these elements that they need to keep advancing their nuclear program?
Well, that black market certainly has existed in the past, and it's still there today. One of the things that you become very good at, if you're like Iran and you've been a pariah state under sanctions for a very long time, is you're really good at kind of getting around the rules, figuring out how to access things that you're not supposed to get. It's a two-way street. They're getting better and better at selling oil, which they're restricted from doing under some of the sanctions. But they have companies in Iraq, for example, that will just rebrand Iranian oil is Iraqi oil, sell it to China or to India. There are plenty of places that want that oil and would love to get a discount on it. So there's that side of it. But the other side is getting sort of the technical stuff. And some of the high-tech material was frankly stolen. There's a famous case of a Pakistani scientist named A.Q. Khan who managed to acquire, while working in Holland, some of the design blueprints for the centrifuge machines. This is the equipment that makes enriched uranium. And so the Pakistanis were selling those around the world. So there is this international weapons bazaar that exists. And the other stuff, a lot of the things that Iran gets, sort of electronics, other things that are sort of technical components, Many of them are Western made by the United States, by the Germans, by the Swiss, and by others. And we even see that more recently on the battlefields in Ukraine, where you have these drones that are attacking Ukrainian cities. Those drones are filled with American electronics, stuff that they buy off just off the off the black market or from normal markets, and they use those to build their weapons. And the same has happened in the case.
You mentioned Israel and what they used to be able to do, what they used to do, because they, from my view, they were the ones that really were probably standing between Iran developing a nuclear weapon and actually doing it. But they've got their hands full right now. So who is standing there at the door, holding the door right now?
All these crazy alien stories can't be true, can they? Hey, it's Stephen Diener, host of the Unidentified Alien Podcast. And whether you're new to the conversation or have been looking into it for years, you need to check out the fastest growing alien show out there, the Unidentified Alien Podcast, or UAP for short. There's a crazy amount of alien encounter stories out there from all over the world. And the beauty of it is that I bring them all to you and let you decide what you believe. Download and subscribe to UAP on any of the major podcasting platforms. And you can also find it on UAPpodcast.com.
Well, the article gets into what we lost because of the collapse of the Iran nuclear deal. Because in the past, there was certainly kinetic options, and we've seen the Israelis again and again take action against Iranians to try to slow their program. It's been everything from assassinations of nuclear scientists, which they've done, quite expertly inside Iran, and we've seen them do other things like. This famous cyber sabotage operation called Stuxnet, which actually covertly disabled or destroyed a lot of Iran's centrifuge equipment. So that has happened in the past. But for a while there was this brief window beginning in 2015 where six big countries, United States, Russia, so that all the nuclear power countries plus the European Union got together and cut a deal with Iran where they would have to keep their nuclear program under very tight control. So they could never make enough uranium of any kind to make even a single bomb. And there are flaws in the program. I think they're pretty clear. There was sort of sunset provisions that allowed some of those restrictions to expire over time. But it did, Iran did honor those commitments, and it did reduce dramatically its nuclear capability under that accord. Now that that's gone, you're asking about who's at the door. Well, the IAEA is not at the door like it used to be. This International Nuclear Watchdog Agency that used to be able to go all over the country and inspect suspicious locations to look at some sensitive laboratories and warehouses, that doesn't happen anymore. And so the sort of the point of the article is that not only is Iran advancing in a dangerous way, but our ability to restrict or inhibit or to change their behavior, that's diminished as well. And this is leaving us at a point where the world is a much more dangerous place, frankly, in my view. And Iran, because it has Russia as an ally now, remember Russia's sort of latched on to Iran as a strategic partner because of Ukraine. And because of that relationship, they're much more confident and just rolling forward with this. And they don't really care what the West thinks.
So speaking of the West, what's your sense of what the Biden administration is doing, if anything, right now, because they too have got their hands full. I mean, I've heard some rumors that they're trying to revive this deal. But what's your sense of what they're doing, and what's the likelihood it'll be successful?
Yeah, well, they did try really hard in the beginning, and Biden campaigned on this idea that he could, if not restore the deal, maybe get a new one, convince the Iranians to come up with a different plan that. Addresses some of the problems and questions that people had with the nuclear deal. Well, there were some, as I said, there were some good questions, but that effort has completely, and we've talked to a lot of folks about this, completely collapsed. And the Biden administration is telling us pretty frankly that we don't put any energy or effort into this anymore because it's been futile. The Iranians aren't interested. They think that the United States reneged on the deal, the last one that we cut when President Trump. Decided in 2018 to completely withdraw, sort of unilaterally withdraw from the agreement. And they say, because of that, we're not interested in negotiating with the United States anymore. So, off with you. And so the Biden administration has has tried to get some traction, but they've failed. And there are reasons for that. Part of it, as I said, the Iranians are a much harder target these days. They aren't as willing to engage with us. And the Biden administration hasn't come up with the ideas or the levers or whatever smoke and mirrors you need to bring them back. And so they're trying to pressure the Iranians in other ways. You know, we've got this situation in the Middle East now with all these proxy groups, the Houthis, the Iraqi militias that are supported by Iran. And we have gone after them on many occasions. And that's sort of an indirect way of striking at the Iranians. But mostly it's really just a matter now of threats and warnings. Keep the sanctions up, but also tell the Iranians, don't pass this line. Don't begin to try to make a nuclear weapon, or we're going to come after you in a more serious way. But that's a much more dangerous conflict than if you're you know, attacking Iran in its homeland, going after its nuclear facility. That's obviously inviting a larger conflict, and that's something that nobody wants. So it is, to be fair to everyone, that's an extremely difficult problem, and there aren't any easy answers right now.
Joby, you mentioned as well, it would possibly take them a few days or a couple of weeks to get three bombs or several bombs. And Iran is a country, as rogue as they are, they're still a country with a lot of money and a lot of access to facilities, diplomatic facilities, this place, that place. But also, they're joined at the hip with a bunch of terror organizations. Yep. So what does this capability look like from that viewpoint, from a terrorism point of view?
Yeah, and I think this has been Iran's strategy, and it's really interesting to see. They're working on a potential deterrent, a potential nuclear weapon. They haven't decided to make one, as far as we can tell, but they've got that capability or very close to it. But the other deterrent for Iran is this militia network that it's built. It's got allies in Hezbollah, which is the Lebanese, you know, pro-Iranian militia group, just parked north of the border of Israel with over 100,000 rockets. And so if there is a conflict with Iran, then Iran can pressure its proxies into striking on Iran's behalf. So you not only have a war between Iran and Israel, but you've got potentially thousands of rockets, much more capable rockets, I would add, compared to what Hamas had, raining into Israeli cities. Some of these rockets have guidance systems. The targeting is better. So you can imagine in a worst case scenario, they're hitting military bases, they're hitting basic infrastructure, even nuclear facilities on the Israeli side. So that's a really serious threat. But Hezbollah and these other proxy groups have tentacles that are around the world. There are sleeper cells, and this has come out in court cases. Iranian agents who operate in Canada, in the United States, and with a phone call or with a message could be activated to try to carry out terrorist attacks in this country. So Iran's capability is no joke. There are lots of things they can do, not just militarily, but through their proxies. They can reach out and hurt a lot of people, including Americans.
So what is the likelihood these groups could, if Iran goes ahead and does what you said they could very likely do with relative ease right now, develop nuclear weapons, what's the likelihood these groups might have access to some of that activity or technology or capability?
One would hope that would never happen. We look at situations like the Syrian civil war, where Syria had a very robust chemical weapons capability, and there were concerns that Syria might give its weapons to Hezbollah or to other militia groups or terrorist groups if the house was falling down, if Syria, the regime, was collapsing. It didn't do that. And the reason appears to be is that these regimes that have these weapons, like when they acquire them, they're very possessive. They don't want to lose control of them. And so it would be a very dire situation, I think, when they might share a weapon with a terrorist group. But you can't rule it out. It's kind of the sum of all fears kind of plot where a rogue general in Iran, feeling that sort of the ship is going down, might decide to do something unilaterally. It's probably a remote possibility, but it's not impossible.
Okay, and very last thing, remind us why, and you've done a brilliant job of this already, but remind us why there are so few countries in the world that have developed nuclear weapons, and these countries developed nuclear weapons many, many, many years ago. Yeah. Remind us why that happened and why it's so difficult now for a country like Iran or North Korea or some other country to develop nuclear weapons now.
Yeah, and you could just go back to the 60s and you see a time when there really was a serious and very real concern that nuclear weapons were going to be everywhere. So you had the United States had them, then the Soviets had them, then the Chinese had them, the British and the French. And for a long time, it was just this handful of very big, powerful countries, and they all kind of kept each other in check. But you know, over the years that followed, many countries acquired the means to make nuclear weapons if they decided to go ahead with the program. Everybody from the Germans, the Japanese have a lot of fissile material. If they wanted to make a nuclear weapon, they would not have any problem doing it. The Taiwanese got very close. You know, the South Koreans have talked about it. But all that has been held in check because of this international regime that's been in place since the 1950s. One of the things that the Eisenhower did in the early days of the nuclear weapons age was to create this international framework, this body called the International Atomic Energy Agency, based in Vienna, whose job would be to keep nuclear weapons from spreading. And that evolved into a system of, you know, agreements around the world where all countries are supposed to sign up to have inspections, to be transparent about their nuclear activities. And it has worked remarkably well. There's been a few countries like India and Pakistan that have weapons. Israel's always been an outlier. North Korea has them now, but the number is small, and that's because this international agreement, this kind of framework that keeps us all from going down a nuclear rabbit hole, has largely held. And that's part of the worry with Iran. It's not just that Iran might get a bomb, as terrible as that is for us to contemplate over here, but it's also the possibility that it would inspire others to do the same, because the Saudis are looking across their border thinking, well, we don't want to live next to an Iranian nuclear power. The Turks may feel the same way. Other countries may decide that we need to rethink our security options and get nuclear weapons too. So that's the kind of nightmare nuclear arms race in the middle of the world's most dangerous region that could happen if one country decides to go nuclear.
That's Washington Post national security correspondent Joby Ward. That's it for this episode of Target USA. Coming up in our next episode, whatever is big or breaking in the world of international security, with a focus on the U.S. or the U.S. is connected to it, we'll have it right here. That's coming up on the next episode of Target USA. In the meantime, if you have any questions or comments about the program, send me an email. You can reach me at jgreen@wtop.com. The letter J, the color green, one word, at Whiskey Tango Oscar Papa. jgreen@wtop.com. Also, please subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Twitter. We're at TUSA Podcast. That's at Tango Uniform Sierra Alpha Podcast. And if you want more national security news, you can sign up for my newsletter. It's called Inside the SCIF, and you can sign up at WTOP.com/email. Thanks to everybody that's helped us put this together, and to Akash Gandhi for the music.
I'm J.J. Green, and this is Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.